Yes, I was looking down here and I didn't realise there's a sort of galaxy of stars in the Royal Circle up there. Anyway, let us get underway because, as you can see, you have an excess of riches before you, i.e. a rather sort of burgeoning panel of people, all of whom wish to speak for a limited period of time. Tony Giddens, whose book and whose lecture tonight we are principally gathered to hear and honour and challenge and question, will speak initially. Then I'm going to ask Dominique Strauss-Kahn, former finance minister of France and leading thinker in the French Socialist Party, to offer a French perspective. Then I'm going to ask Reinhard Hesse, who is an advisor and close aide of the German Chancellor, Gerhard Schröder, to give a German perspective on what Tony is saying. Anne Power, Professor of Social Policy here at the School, Will Hutton, Director, Chief Executive of the Industrial Society, Michael Jacobs, the General Secretary of the Fabian Society, will add their respective postscripts to what the others have said, which is by way of saying they have literally 5 minutes each and they will be chaired with a rod of iron. I will be only marginally more respectful and deferential to the director of the school. But thank you very much indeed for coming. This meeting is a joint meeting organised by the Fabian Society, which needs little or no introduction to you, although I want to make one remark about the Fabian Society in a minute. Policy Network, of which I am the chair, which may need more introduction, it's not a centre, it is not a think tank, it is a Europe-wide and actually international organisation that provides a means for communicating, disseminating, debating policies and ideas on the progressive centre-left, particularly comparing different national governments' experience on the centre-left and bringing policymakers together to share and exchange their respective experience in attempting to implement progressive ideas in practice. And Polity Press, which is publishing primarily the book that Tony has written and which is being launched today. I just want to say one thing, though, about the Fabian Society, as I've been a member of the Fabian Society all my life. It is Britain's senior left of centre think tank, in the sense that it is the longest established, and so many stars and very good people from the Labour movement have passed through its ranks and have done an enormous amount of good work using the Fabian Society as the vehicle for that work. It does accept individual members. It needs individual members for its political and financial base. And if you're not members of the Fabians, you certainly should be, and appropriate membership forms are outside or whatever. Now, without any further ado, therefore, if you haven't got seats, there's some seats over there, but there are some more down here if you're full up in the upper
circle. Just some people come down because
there are some seats over there, but if you want to be sure of a seat, you can come down here. So without any further ado, I'm going to ask Tony Giddens to speak for 10 minutes or so in order to introduce his book, Where Now for New Labour. Tony.
Well, thank you very much, Peter, and I'm very pleased to have such an immensely distinguished panel here tonight. I came here primed to give a lecture, and now I've got to talk for 8 minutes strictly, which is not in my nature to do. So what I'm going to do is very briefly summarise the content of this work. Like Gaul, it divides into three parts. In the first part of the book, what I try and do is provide an analysis of the level of political debate in this country, which I think is often much more superficial and ill-informed than it should be. The reason for this, or some part of the reason, which I think this discussion might help in a minor way to remedy, is the insularity of much political discussion here, which often takes place outside of any comparative context, except perhaps sometimes for the USA. I think this is quite different from the situation in many continental European countries, where journalists and other writers in the media are very conscious of what's going on with New Labour in the UK, very conscious of changes in the UK more generally, but the reverse by and large does not hold, and it should hold. I feel we need more comparative debate. One of the important things about the Wanless report, if you've seen that interim Wanless report, is at least it places the debate about the health service in a much wider comparative context. Second part of the book is essentially an assessment of the achievements or otherwise of the Labour government during its first period of government, the first 4 years of government. It's now 6 months into a second phase of government. I mean, Labour has been endlessly criticised from both sides of the political spectrum, but I think its record is really quite remarkable, and I say this as a completely neutral and detached observer. In terms of second landslide victory, a lot was said about the low turnout in the election, but in fact, studies since the election show the majority of people who didn't vote in the election would have voted Labour if they had have voted. The election also shows, as Bob Worcester sitting in the front row here, who are obligated for some of these findings, that proportion of the population who now supports anything close to a Thatcherite view of the UK and its role in the world has shrunk to about 27 or 28% of the electorate. This is a quite extraordinary transformation, I think, and I think the electorate now has a kind of Euro-realism in its attitudes towards the wider world, a reluctant cosmopolitanism, if you like, but a cosmopolitanism nevertheless. I was reading an article in the Evening Standard yesterday about people's views of the economic competence of the Labour government. Virginia won't, I'm sure, approve this very much, but it's a very interesting finding of business leaders in London, which fully 80% say that they believe Labour to be economically competent in running the economy. Do you know what proportion say the Tories are economically competent? 1% in this survey. Well, that's a terrific turnaround. Who would have thought it was possible? Redistribution. Labour's been endlessly criticised from the left for not having systematically redistributed income and wealth to poorer groups, but I feel this criticism is very wide of the mark. I think you'd find it hard to find a previous Labour government which actually has secured as much redistribution as this one. The working families tax credit, the other forms of tax credits, a range of policies to do with targeted anti-poverty policies. Anne will no doubt speak about this perhaps in a more critical vein than me later on. I've lifted well over 1 million people out of poverty. Most of those people are children. The proportion of workless households has dropped. There's a long way to go, but these are, I think, impressive results. I don't want to whitewash New Labour. I think many mistakes were made in the first period of government, and some of those mistakes were presentational. I think the idea that you can simply control what the media say, that you can influence too directly and systematically how the policies of New Labour are presented, this rebounded very heavily on the party and on the government, because people came to think that it's a government empty of policies. I think anyone who looks through the record of the government see the opposite of the case. It's stuffed full of policies, and many of those, I think, have been, on the whole, pretty successful, although, as I try and show in the book, there's a long way to go with some of them. Third part of the book, I guess, is the part that might interest people here most, at least Michael Jacobs tells me that this is the case when we had discussion of how I should present this earlier on. This is where New Labour should go now. The world has changed. We have a global economic downturn, a recession in the United States, had the terrible events of September 11, and while our European, continental European friends are on the platform here, they'll be conscious, as I'm sure many people here will, that there's been a return of the right, not just in the US, but in a range of European countries recently, including Austria, Italy, Denmark, Portugal, and outside of the EU, Norway. So this is a different environment, I think, from the past. In addition, every political party has to renew itself, and I think there is a serious range of issues around what kind of direction this renewal should take. Well, I have my own views on this, and let me just mention two or three of them in, under the category of what should Labour do now? Questions. I think, first of all, fundamental thing ideologically is that we need a second phase of development of new Labour, not a reversion to anything close to what old Labour used to be. I think this does demand more ideological thinking. I think Labour does need more of a marching tune than it's had before, and I don't think it's actually that difficult to provide it. I think Labour should be the party that defends public institutions, that defends public services, does so against a backdrop, however, of promoting the wider economic prosperity of the country as a whole, but insists that public institutions are not the same as the state. That, to me, is where old Labour went wrong and still tends to go wrong today. The state is crucial for delivering certain services, but there are big problems with some forms of state delivery of public services. The public sphere, public institutions, they range more widely than the state, and we can have a variety of ways of delivering on this. In the range of what should Labour do questions, what should Labour do about public services directly? Well, my first remedy that I talked about quite extensively in the meeting we had this morning is don't panic, because a range of public services in the UK are working pretty well. Some of these include public services which have been privatized, utilities, telecommunications, and so forth. You're talking primarily about the NHS and transport when you're talking about a crisis of public services. There is essentially, I think, no crisis in the NHS. The NHS stands up quite robustly to pan-European comparisons. Oh, dear. Oh, 5 minutes left. Oh, that's not too bad. The NHS stands up quite robustly to pan-European comparisons. I feel the Labour Party's NHS plan is a good one. It achieved a great deal of support from within the NHS. The key problems for the future are organisational. They certainly involve investment. And we are talking about a long-term period of underinvestment, but we're also talking about the need to look again comparatively about the limits and possibilities of divergent health systems. Look at the Wanless report. It covers 7 industrial countries. It shows that in not a single one of those 7 countries are the majority of the population satisfied with their health service. The railways, well, I'm sure we'll discuss that, and I won't talk about it in any detail. The railways are partly a natural monopoly, and every country with a railway system has problems about running it. 2 sorts of problems, really. Those which are run through the state quite often have massive debts because of state overexpenditure on the system. That's why they privatized the railways in Japan, for example. They built up a massive debt there in the railway system. Quite a few European countries, you probably know, are experimenting with privatizing parts of the railway system. Anyone thinks that you should renationalize the railways, I think that's, to my mind, completely inoperative idea. A good amount of the problems with the railway system come from the period of nationalization when there was radical underinvestment and poor management for quite a long period of when you're talking about British Rail. I think another thing I mentioned about problems of debate in this country, memory loss, comes into play. Many people have forgotten what PR was like and forgotten about the limitations, I think, of it. I think the government's seeming intention to explore very seriously having a non-profit making trust to run the railways is certainly, as Tony Grayling says in his IPPR report, an option which deserves direct and detailed examination. But there is no magic bullet way of coping with transport systems in countries where many, many more people want to travel by car and train than ever did in previous generations. Second, what should Labour do about tax? My view is, first of all, Labour must continue to absorb the lessons which it's learned about taxation, which separates new Labour from old Labour. First of all, taxation is not just about social justice. The left always concentrates on taxation as a means of producing social justice. Taxation is a much more complex phenomenon. Taxation and fiscal measures are directly relevant to economic performance. It sometimes makes sense to reduce taxes to promote job creation and to promote more effective economic development. And the complexity of the relationship between fiscal systems and economic development needs to be noted. Secondly, New Labour made, I think, the right move in concentrating not on tax rates, but on the size of the tax take. Labour have elevated the tax take over the first 4 years by about 3%, which is a very significant increase without basically increasing tax rates. I think it is quite possible that tax rates will need to be increased about 2 or 3 years from now, because most people know there is a kind of hole in the public finances then. But that depends a lot upon what the rate of economic development is and other events in the wider world. I say no return to tax and spend, at least in the traditional form of tax and spend. We need a much more sophisticated approach to taxation than the left has had in the past. Finally, thirdly, devolution. I'm a strong believer in devolution, decentralization of power. I think the devolution to the nations has been, by and large, successful, even though it's brought problems, of course, with it, and even though many people in Scotland, for example, feel dissatisfied with it, I feel that, by and large, devolution has been successful. The big gap is England. I think pressures for regional development and for devolution in England, sooner or later, will become irresistible. I'm in favour of further devolution to the English regions. We're all waiting to see what this celebrated white paper that's been on the stocks for about 6 months now will actually say, and Peter's contributed very significantly to that debate. I think it's time to confront both the problems as well as the possibilities of English devolution. In conclusion, since I've got 1 minute left, and I'll try and keep under that minute, I think my assessment of Labour's first period in government would be mixed, like anybody's, but I feel the Labour Party is probably in the strongest position of any left-of-centre party in Europe at the moment. It is in this position. The Tories have been marginalised because of the transformation of Labour from old Labour to new Labour. To me, new Labour doesn't mean the kind of flaky things that it's associated with at all. It's part of a more generic move among all left-of-centre parties to restructure their policies and their ideological outlook to do two things: to win elections, which left-of-centre parties have been very poor at doing, mostly across Europe in the past, and second, once elections have been won, to put into practice policies which have bite and which actually work. And I feel on both of those things, New Labour thus far has actually delivered pretty well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very good.
Thank you very much, Tony. Dominic Strauss-Kahn.
Well, thank you, Peter. I want to say how pleased I am to be with you tonight and try to give you how many may I have? How many?
Ten.
Ten-ish.
Ten, yes, we want to hear you.
Good.
You've come a long way.
Okay, 10 minutes. I'll try to speak slowly.
Eight.
Try to give you a few comments from the French point of view. As you know, it's often been said that the New Labour and the French Socialists are poles apart, or if not poles apart, at least are the two extreme representation of the left in Europe. the New Labour being obviously the most modern one, and the French Socialist being what is still alive from the old Socialist or the old Labour here. I think that, it's partly true and partly wrong. What you have to take into account is that we're not starting from the same point. We have a long history of intervention of the state in the economy and in the society as a whole, and it's part of the French identity. The French nation has been built around the idea of the state, at least for the last two centuries. And if you look on a shorter period, let's say the last 20 years or 25 years, you experienced 20 years of Thatcherism, which was probably a very specific period. We didn't have this kind of chance, and so obviously the way or the situation in which was the government of Lionel Jospin in 97 when we won the election was totally different from the situation of Tony Blair at the same period or some months before. But this image is not totally wrong, I said it, but not totally true. And at least during the last 5 years, the French socialists did move a lot. We learned a lot, being in power, and we changed a lot. And certainly we're no more this traditional tax and spend left as always described in Europe. Let's say just a few words about tax and a few words about spend. During the last 5 years, we are now finishing our mandate. As you may know, we have a presidential election in a few months and general election also in a few months. During the last 5 years, taxes will have diminished about of £10 billion on the business side, and that was what I did, and it was on a 6 year period, so it's about 1.5 billion pound per year for 6 years. And that's what I did when I was a finance minister, and Laurent Fabius, who is the finance minister now, did almost the same thing, around £10 billion on the income tax. And it's the first time in my country where the income tax will diminish for decades. And if you look on the expenditure side, there's a very striking figure, which is that the total state expenditure did grow from 1.8%. That did grow about 1.8% in 5 years, while they did grow with a rate of growth of 1.8% per year during the 5 year period previous, which was where the Conservatives were in charge. So it's five times less during the last period, the left period. So both on taxes and on expenditure, and I could give you a lot of more figures if you're interested in, both sides, obviously, the French socialists are no more, even having some communists in the government, are no more the traditional tax and spender that we used to be. So from a lot of point of view, we're not so different from what the New Labour tried to implement. And I think that the opposition, traditional opposition, which is made between the French and the Brits, and the German being just maybe in between, I don't know, you will say, is a totally wrong opposition. The question we have to solve, the debate in the society are the same on public services. For instance, we have exactly the same debate, probably not on the same topic. The question for us is not the transportation system or the railway system. And, you don't ask me any kind of advice, but if I give you a piece of advice, it would be not to nationalize the railway system. We have a nationalized railway system, and I think we will have it for decades because there's no chance that anybody will buy this system now. So the problem is not on the railway system, but we have the same problem on what could be the same thing in France, probably the pension system. The pension system is obviously a question we didn't handle during the last 5 years. We will have to do so if we win the next election, and it's as big a question as probably the transportation system in this country. So we have the same kind of problem on public services, how to manage them, and obviously it's not a question of own a public ownership or private ownership. It's a question of how we're able to have good services for the population. And if we take other question, the privatization question on industrial assets, I think the view we have now on both sides of the channel is exactly the same one. On meritocracy, and compare the question of meritocracy to equality, I think also we share the same view. So what I would say is that we're moving toward the same point, starting from different points. So what we have to do is not exactly the same thing, but the target is the same, and probably it's the same for all the left movement in Europe today. The problem we have is that we're doing everything at home. And of course we do meet, governments have meeting, academic have meeting, businessmen have meeting, but very few meetings. At the end of the day, everybody is working at home without taking much into account what kind of experience you have, what kind of practice you have, and with very little exchange on best practices. So, in my opinion, we should really try to develop much more than we did before those kind of seminar where we can just know what you did. We had here in London a few months ago, under the organized by Policy Network, a very interesting seminar on pension, where the Swedish and the German and the French and the Brits, of course, came with their own problem, saying, okay, finally, we have the same problem. That's the way we try to solve it. And the other thing, we have another way. It worked. It didn't work. Finally, the problem is to see, having the same problem, what kind of solution work and what kind of solution can be transportable from one country to another one, which is not the case of all solutions, because part of the solution are rooted in the history and the past, but some may be translated in another language. So we need that, not only for leaders, but for all the society. And I think one of the big things to do in the coming years is to be able to organize this kind of connection of the different European society, national societies, people from different parts of the society, just to exchange experience, to see that we have almost the same view on what we should do, and to be able to take benefit from what the other did. Because obviously the question we have to solve are almost the same. We have to solve the question of slowdown in economic growth, and it's true for all our countries. We have to face question of geopolitics linked with September 11, and I can speed. and the problem is the same for all of us. And I was saying before, some friends are there in this building, that when I look the way the Brits react to 9/11, sometimes I wish I were British compared to what we did. It's always the case, but in this case, I think you did it very well. And that's a good example of the way we can learn from each other. But if there is one point on which the agenda is not the same one, it's probably the European question, and especially the euro. Obviously, we're not in the same situation. We choose for a very long time to be in the first train, in the first move for the euro, and we succeed in doing that. For political reason, the conservative government decided in the past in Britain to do something different, and certainly it wasn't possible for the new Labour to speed up. But now the question you're facing, and especially now where the banknotes and the coins in euro have been launched with the success that everybody has contemplated, the question you're facing now is, What are you going to do? Not only how much time are you able to join, but how to convince the people in the street that your place is in the euro, because your place is in Europe. And there's, at the end of the day, no place in Europe without being in the euro. I said it a bit roughly and a bit rapidly, but I think that the euro is today the most best defined produce of the building of Europe, and there's no way that you will stay outside. When I say there's no way you will stay outside, I mean that, of course, for the euro, it will be a very good thing to have the Brits on board, and we wish so, we wish that. If finally the Brits decide not to come, it's your own problem, but we will do without. But it is nonsense to try to build Europe with by step and pragmatic step, as the as we did for 40 years, and now with the currency after pragmatic step, without having the Brits on board. This will be at the heart of the political campaign we will have in a few months in France. Generally, European question, or more generally even the international question, are not very much discussed during a political campaign because people are not interested in. But in this case, it will probably be somewhat different owing to the launching of the euro and the enthusiasm that everybody may have seen. So I think we will have in France a very important discussion about what's coming now. What are we going to do now? Because my opinion is, I won't elaborate too much on this, but my opinion is that the launching of the banknotes last week is only a small step in establishing and the euro, and in the euro process is not achieved. So we have a lot of things to do as far as economic policy and coordination of the economic policy is concerned, for instance. And for all that, of course, we need Britain to be on board. Other question in this election would be question you also have to solve all you already solved, the reform of the state, re-engineering the state machine, question like that. What we didn't do during the last 5 years, we did other things. We created a lot of jobs, 2 million jobs. I give you only figures on it and then I will stop. In my country, 5 million jobs have been created during the last century, from 1900 to year 2000. In this 5 million job, 2 million jobs have been created during the last 5 years. So that's part of the results of the French economy, and of course it's linked to the huge quality of the French Minister of Finance and Economy, but also mainly to the fact that we were protected by the euro, and that for the first time we could have a policy oriented toward domestic question without having to take into account the external value of the currency. It never happened in our history, and the results are there. So all those questions are questions for the next election, and in this context, the book written by Tony is very useful for the ideological and also for the day-to-day tactical debate in my country, because as I said when I started these few words, and I will end on this, you take some advance in thinking about the future of the left in this country. And because you did it sometime before we are doing it ourselves, it's very useful to take into account the step you already did, the step forward, what you're going to do, what you're writing on the future. And so a book like the Anthony Giddens' book is certainly useful. I suppose it's useful for the New Labour here, but it's even more useful for the French socialists, and that's the reason why I was so glad to be here today.
Thank you very much for that 8 minutes, Dominic. Now, Reinhard Hesse, who works very closely to Gerhard Schröder.
How much do I have? Same. I came quite a longer way than Dominic. But then again, he said everything I wanted to say about the euro, so that will give...
You've got 8 minutes. Get on with it.
I'll take his 10. Okay. Well, to be very frank, Anthony, when I read your book, I was a bit astonished. And I said, look, these people, and, well, I've always been keeping my respect to your due distance to this government in Britain, whom you're watching closely, but you don't have too many close relations to, I assume. And when you read it and you say, well, he's... citing all the problems that we have, he's citing the agenda, and there we are. But haven't they been in power for 4 years? and isn't this what you do when you have to campaign? Then I found out, and I woke up in the middle of the night, apparently you didn't have to campaign in Britain because you didn't have any adversaries. Am I right here? Which is corresponds to your findings about the business community and their confidence and economic competence of the Tories. So not everybody, unfortunately, is that lucky. So I think as good as it is to remind us all of the achievements that have been done, that this might, at the end of the day, not be enough to just say what we had to do. And on the other hand, this is probably one of our problems and one of our difficulties in communicating within the European left, central left, whatever that is, progressive parties, social democrats, socialist, new labor, that we had a task in the last years to modernize our societies, and that modernization was by itself the precondition to create what we want to develop as a modern society and as a prerequisite for social justice, for participation, and for a more democratic society. But it came, and it had to come, in the guise of a modernizing program. Now, modernizing is not exactly what is, apart from those people who are apparently winning by it, and then again they might not win again, as we have seen with the dot-coms, modernizing is not in such a political philosophy. So I think at this point, and this is why I was very, very interested in your book and why I was thinking so much about it, is that maybe it's just now that after having fulfilled, performed the most important task of modernizing, that we think about, well, what is the idea of society that we have after all? Because right now we were fighting so much, and I think this goes for the French just as well as for the Germans, as for the British, as for all of us, as for the Swedish, fighting so much against the idea of left parties, socialist parties, labor parties, wanting to change society, this especially after 89, wanting to be the grandfather of everybody and bring luck by social systems and social programs and ideologies, that first of all we were so pragmatic that we forgot all about our agenda for creating. And here I envy you British guys, and I envy the Americans, I envy all of you who can say a good society. If I said this in German, people would yell at me. I would not come out of here unhurt if I said eine gute Gesellschaft. My God. Well, I envy you. Great. So let me just to wrap this up, the thing about modernization, and let me just give you an anecdote about the German experience. When you modernize, and when you modernize, which means you adapt to the globalization, to the necessities of developing information, telecommunication, which you do out of a very good conscience, out of a very good drive for social justice, because you know employment, for instance, which is the door to create to include to social inclusion, employment will only be created through new production and new employment and new products and new markets. So you have an agenda to modernize, first of all, and this is basically where, in first place, and for a pragmatic voter, you might make a difference between, you might spell out the difference between a conservative program and a center-left program. And then you might get a lot of applause from people who are running business, because, well, once you modernize, they like it. You spell out the right thing, we need more flexibility in the labor markets, we need to deregulate. Fine. Your applause is from the business side. We need to have tax incentives for innovation. Your applause is from the business side. The problem is, I sometimes have my doubts if these friends who applaud actually deliver. Well, of course they deliver, but do they deliver as much as we deliver on the other side? So instead of discussing, like, are we still socialists, which is something, some sublines I have been reading in your book, for instance, Can we fence off the criticism that we betrayed some of the old fashioned social equality ideas and so on and so on and so? Is it good enough while we're doing this, is it good enough, on the other hand, not to say, well, you guys, although we do not believe in punishment taxation, as I like to dub it, although we do not believe in regulating and over-regulating everything, but isn't there a kind of responsibility when the government is modernizing, when politics is modernizing, that business also has to contribute this effort to modernize? Well, this is just one of the questions. The thing is, I think that, well, we all know that we can't even settle on a common currency, so how could we settle on a common idea of a leftist party? Well, of course we couldn't. We couldn't even settle on a color for it. If you go to Germany and you say, well, we should work like New Labour is working, everybody will come and say, okay, so you want to have spin doctoring. So, okay, well, I thought spin doctoring was a computer game. Well, we don't know about this. So, on the other hand, so you want to do it the French way. You want to go to bed with communists. Well, I want to do that. So we stuck to say, well, okay, look, we don't need all these things. We're the oldest socialist party. I'm not a member there. And I'm very grateful, by the way, Anthony, that you named one of your chapters the Groucho Marx Syndrome. I remember one day I told you that when you asked me if I'm a member of the Social Well, one day you asked me if I was a member of the Social Democratic Party, and I told you I'm sticking to the Groucho Marx thesis, which is, how could you want to be a member of a club that would like to include you? So I think you were criticizing some younger people who were not wanting to volunteer and come out and be young pioneers for New Labour. Although I think this could be a good idea. Because, I'm not joking here. Because I think what we really have to do now in this, and this is one of the reasons, we should not only talk more, we should talk more intensively, and we should talk about a deeper and more interesting agenda. I think, for instance, taxation. Taxation leads us to something which always makes me think of the past and the future at one time. Now, in the political debate, I don't think you really have anybody who could ask for high raises in taxation, or that taxation could lead to a better society. I don't think so. And I have not encountered anybody who really advocates this idea. What the problem is, though, that there is different models. Probably Germany's model is the most complicated one, because we have we need to employ people who have to work for like 3 months on my personal tax declaration, although I'm not a tax evader and I don't earn a lot of money. But this can give you a sign. The problem, I think, is why don't we reach harmony in taxes in Europe, and why don't we reach a clear-cut idea of taxation, is that we have not put the first question, is how much money does the state want and how much money does the society want to give the state and for what purpose? And I think this is the stage which we have to reach. We have to pursue our discussion. We have to go beyond the problems that we all know, NHS in Britain, Krankenversicherung, health service in Germany, which is going awash and practically broke. We have come one step in direction of a pension reform. Others might have not. The French will probably look at us and say, okay, well, we might not make some mistakes that we're just about to make. We have enormous problem in the labor market, which you don't have. On the other hand, we don't have a poverty problem as much as you have. But the basic idea is, can we find a new consensus, and how do we want society to react, society debate, and how we want to enhance society to be a society again in a globalized world. And this will answer the question of taxation, because then it will be democratic again, because you will have a participation approach to that. And this is why Peter is telling me I have 1 minute left. No, Peter, I will give it to you.
Actually lost a minute because of that joke about spin doctors. Now, this is where it's going to get really brutal, I'm afraid. 3 minutes. You're off, Anne Powell.
I think New Labour's got a really serious challenge, and I'm really glad that someone like Tony Giddens is standing up and saying that, on the one hand, they've done some amazingly positive things, and on the other hand, they need to work from a flexible base because we don't really know where we're going. I suppose the only defect in Tony's book is that he doesn't bluntly say, we don't know where we're going, which is what I think is the big challenge we face. And I'll link that to my social policy concerns. First of all, international migration is a really huge issue of completely unknown proportions. At the moment, over 1 million newcomers arrive in the EU every year, another 1 million arrive in the US every year. There are 23 million people on the move at any one time. And managing that problem and incorporating those people into vulnerable communities at the bottom, which is where they usually land up, is one of the huge challenges of New Labour. A lot of that migration is driven by the environmental imperative. People are leaving the land because there's less and less arable land per head of population worldwide as environmental degradation progresses. And urban areas are becoming bigger and bigger and more predatory as they sprawl under the pressure of poor in-migration, which in turn fuels international migration. So we're facing a kind of world disorganisation that nobody quite knows how it's going to hold up. And in Britain, we've seen very serious racial disorders over the last few months, partly, in fact, largely, I would argue, as a consequence of those pressures. So the poorest people are basically dog-eat-dog at the bottom while we struggle with the organisational challenges. I'll just give two examples of what I think we need to focus on. If we actually sorted out our waste disposal, this will sound a very trivial point, we would transform environmental conditions in poor neighbourhoods, and we would actually make a huge impact on the whole ecological challenge of the 21st century. Britain is appalling in its record compared with all other European countries, even very poor and disorganised European countries of the Mediterranean and the United States. We recycle on average about 11% of our waste, whereas other countries recycle 30 to 50%. We repair very, very little. And while not wanting to give a lot of credit to Thatcher, she did say something pretty impressive when she latched onto these problems. We don't hold the freehold on the earth, only a full repairing leasehold. If we understood what a full repairing leasehold meant for our poor neighbourhoods, I think a lot of the disorders we've seen in the last few months could have possibly been avoided. And so my key point is that the third way doesn't really add up to anything other than that we're struggling to find a way through a morass of conflicting pressures and problems in a world that's become hugely uncertain, with pressures and constraints that we can't actually predict at the moment, but which require a lot of light-footed work and a really radical change in the way we organise things. So good luck on that agenda.
Will Hutton, same time.
Where now for New Labour? I like a lot of what Tony has written. I thought his point about differentiating the state from the public sphere was well made. And his book is very strong on the need for precise the point that's just been made about the environment to be at the centre of the centre and centre-left politics in the years ahead. But I found his remedy, he won't be surprised to hear me say this, and I've profited a lot from arguing with Tony over the last, more years than I like to remember, actually. Where I think, and my key point is this, where I think we're now for New Labour, I think Labour's task is to build a distinct British variant of Europe's economic and social model. And the reason why Tony hesitates to say that, as clearly as I think he should say it, is because he has bought, and I think he's been wrong to buy it, essentially an American conservative proposition, which is that Europe doesn't work. And I think Europe actually works rather well with the problem of unemployment, which I'll say a few words about. I think that Dominique and Reinhard come from countries where for every 5 years since 1980, every five-year period in 1980, whole economy productivity growth has been higher, I'm talking about net output, than the US. Output per man hour in France is 7% higher than in the US. It's 6% higher in Germany than the US. There has been an undertold story of a remarkable productivity surge in both countries. And that's been done at the same time as remarkable social outcomes have been achieved. Income and social mobility in both countries is higher than that in the US. The poverty Reinhard reflected, exit rates from poverty in both France and Germany are higher than in the US. They've got a remarkable health service, remarkable public provision of education, and all the rest. My view is that that is blighted by a remarkable, by a disastrous record on employment. In Germany, Reinhard, I would love to hear him speak about this. I think it comes broadly from East Germany rather than West Germany. But actually, again, looking at employment growth in both countries, OECD figures to the end of 2001, and actually the projections for 2002, notwithstanding recession, reinforce it. Employment generation, on average, in France and Germany and Italy has been higher than in Britain. They work a lot better than actually is allowed by Tony's pamphlet. And I don't think the future is about these cheap, low-service sector jobs that he admires so much in the US. I think the big story about what's happened in France and Germany has been that demand in both countries has been running at literally less than half the rate of growth than in Britain and in the US. And that is probably the single most important cause of their economic ailments. I don't think that you should divide the economic into a world in which you have to kind of keep taxes low, deregulate, and dum-da-dum-da-dum. And actually, yes, you want to do nice social outcomes, but smart in order to protect this deregulated world of the economic, which is the essence of wealth generation. I think the sources of wealth generation are much more complicated than recognized either in our national conversation or in Tony's book. They're about how organizations marshal resources. They're about how you get smart and creative organizations. They're about the institutions that buttress that, and it's about the supply of human capital into those organizations. And my view is that if Britain learnt some lessons from France and Germany, and actually the Nordic countries, and actually less from the US, we could set about a national project building a distinct British variant of a European economic and social model and fit into Europe and actually make the case for the euro much better than we'll be able to without doing that. But there's lots in this book I agree with, notwithstanding what I've just said.
Thanks, Will, very much. Michael Jacobs.
Thank you very much indeed, and I would like to add my welcome to you all on behalf of the Fabian Society. I want to, like Will, say that there's much I agree with, but to pick a bone with Tony on something which he stressed in what he said today and talks about in his pamphlet, which is tax. And in some ways, I think it's rather odd that Tony should be emphasizing in the way he does that there should be no return to old Labour-style tax and spend just at the time when the debate in the UK has been shifting. And I am very willing to accept that there should be no return to old-style, old Labour tax and spend. Rather, what there should be is moving forward to a new-style, new Labour tax and spend. Governments tax and spend. It is ridiculous, if I may say so, to say that we shouldn't be taxing and spending. That is what governments do. And governments in the United Kingdom, for 30 years, have taxed and spent at a consistently lower level than those of our European neighbours. And the result of that is now beginning to enter the public consciousness of this country. It's the decades of underinvestment. The most interesting statistic that I've come across in recent weeks was produced in the Wanlis report for the Treasury on the National Health Service, which Tony referred to, which has calculated the amount of underinvestment in the NHS in the UK compared to the European average since 1972. And it's over £200 billion. That's what we haven't spent on our health service that has been spent in the European average. And if you add to that the underspend, cumulative underspend in transport, mostly under nationalisation, as Tony quite rightly says, and then in education, because I don't think it's only a crisis in those two services, and in social services and in other areas. You get, I think, to the root of our real problem, which is a British problem, and much as I welcome the comparison with France and Germany and other European countries, which Tony makes, absolutely critical to the way we think about things here, it is not a problem which has afflicted those countries. It is this deep cultural unwillingness over a long period to pay for public services. And we're now living with the consequences. For a long time, we didn't live with the consequences because you don't see the consequences of underinvestment for a long time. We now can see what we're living with. And yes, Tony's absolutely right to say that simply raising tax rates won't do it, that the economy has to perform well and you generate tax takes out of economic growth. He's right to say we need to think carefully about taxation. But the key issue now facing the UK is whether we are willing to pay more for our public services. And remarkably, this has now, in a shift of New Labour rhetoric, become the talk of Gordon Brown and the Prime Minister, and indeed Peter Mandelson, following the pre-budget statement where we have said perhaps we are now at the position where we have to raise taxes. But we don't do this in the old way. We don't do this willy-nilly. We just say to the British public, cough up some more money. We have to say to the British public, you need to know where these taxes are going. And the Fabian Society, as some of you may know, produced a report last year called Paying for Progress, a report of our Commission on Taxation and Citizenship, available outside for a cheap $9.95, which argued the new way of doing this, not the old way, the new way of doing this, which is to insist that the public know where their money is going, partly through earmarking taxes, partly through better public information, partly through greater accountability. And to give the public the confidence that when they pay taxes, this will go to improving public services. I think this is not an abstract point in the way that I fear Tony makes it, which is that we shouldn't in some way go have a general predisposition to raising taxes. We shouldn't have a general predisposition. We should have a disposition now, because this is the particular circumstances which the UK faces at the moment. And I think in the rejuvenation of the left of centre, and indeed of New Labour, this will become the central question. And it's deep and it's cultural and it's about the relationship between citizens and government. And this seems to me to be where we need to take the debate now. Thank you.
Right. Well, now is the time and your opportunity to rise up in support of Tony Giddens and what he has written in his book. But if you want to put, they all read The Independent. I think the best thing to do, there are lots of things that Tony can and should say in response to the various bones that have been picked over his book. But I'd like to give a chance to all of you, should you wish to take the opportunity, to make very short points or put particular points to members of the panel who have spoken. Please do not, though, make speeches. You won't have the chance to do so because something awful will happen to you. There's a roving mic, and we will come to that lady first. Just there.
Thank you very much. I wonder whether anyone would be prepared to give a view about whether or not we should improve the mechanisms that exist for people to participate in policy decisions, or even perhaps to create new mechanisms for public participation?
Let's take a few questions, and then just to give people time to think. This gentleman there.
Thank you. Tony Giddens mentions in his book that there are obvious disincentives to increase taxation. Reminds us of something David Steele said many years ago about needing £1,000 to get a particular company director out of bed after a Howe budget. Does Tony seriously hold the view that high levels of taxation actually are a disincentive to people going out to work rather than an incentive to get them to work more to pay their tax and maintain the high standard of living.
Right, we'll come back to Tony in a moment. I'm going to take one over here, and then is there anyone? Just show your hands. Right. Okay. One there.
My name is Dane Clouston. I'm director of the Campaign for Universal Inheritance, which is an idea related to equality of opportunity, which has been picked up and published in an excellent Fabian Society leaflet as a capital idea. Do the speakers agree that in a democratic capitalist society, there is a right not only to universal suffrage, or votes for all, but also to universal inheritance, or capital for all, financed by and itself subject to the progressive tax on inheritance and capital gifts?
Right. Can we just take that lady there and then over there? One from each side.
I would just like to ask Tony Atkinson to elaborate a bit in what sense Labour in what sense it is an achievement of New Labour that the British people show some kind of Europe realism, because my impression really is that they behave opportunistically, Gordon Brown and Tony Blair neutralizing the stance on Europe as regards, for example, the euro money itself, and they just hope that reality will do the work for them, namely that some kind of euroization, for example, takes place, and then afterwards we can say we are responsible for that realism that sets in the British consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. If we went down the road of hypothecation of tax as advocated in the Fabian Tax Commission, would that be likely to end up with the end of the massive subsidies that currently most town dwellers pay to farmers underpinned by the Common Agricultural Policy?
Right, let's take a clutch of questions concerning tax, Tony, and perhaps Dominic might come in as well, because I think there are some, there's Michael's bone that you might want to pick up as well.
I do indeed, yes, I do, because some...
But don't ignore hypothecation, the CAP and universal inheritance and our high levels of taxation, a disincentive in the economy.
No, I think that what Michael says is only at best partly correct. Can I say the reason for this? The reason for where public services in this country are worse than elsewhere, and that's something itself that needs investigating. It's not clear they always are worse than elsewhere, certainly than the majority of EU countries, certainly not in all public sectors, it's not true, but where they are, the reason for this is not simply that taxation has been lower in this country. The reason is just as much to do with the fact that for 30 or so years, this country was essentially the sick economy of Europe, and there was simply much less affluent than most of the other EU countries. Therefore, there was less money to spend on public goods, public services, public institutions. A key thing that you have to remember is you have to balance this out. Therefore, you must insist that fiscal mechanisms, much more complicated than many people seem to think they are, and you must have a fiscal system which encourages, as I mentioned, job creation and economic prosperity. Getting a high proportion in work above a decent minimum wage is crucial for generating the money to spend on public services. That's exactly what New Labour achieved during its first 4 years of government. And at the moment, the Treasury has more money to spend than it could spend without flouting some EU regulations and causing other problems in the economy. So I think the issue of taxation and further rises in taxation, which I'm not necessarily against, I think is not necessary at the moment. Personally, I think hypothecated tax for the NHS, which was suggested in the Fabian Society Commission on Tax, which Michael talked about, that is definitely worth considering. Because I think in the case of the NHS, as an additional tax, it wouldn't necessarily have the consequences which many people say hypothecated taxes have. So I think that at least demands serious exploration. If I can comment just briefly about the question about Euro-realism and cosmopolitanism among the British electorate, I think that what the results of the last election are really instructive in this. I don't know how many people have seen them, but we've now got detailed analyses in several books of the attitudes and views of the electorate in the election. Interestingly, they don't show an increase in political apathy, like many people seem to imagine. And interestingly, even among those who didn't vote, they say that they are believers in democracy and they believe us in the right to vote. They think voting important, even though they didn't vote themselves. I think there is a generic shift of attitudes which is traceable in people's responses in these studies since the last election, which, to my mind, they don't show an active, loving embrace of cosmopolitanism or the European Union or the Euro, but they show a realistic attitude towards these things and an open, relatively flexible attitude towards them because, as many people here will know, the majority of the population say they don't want to join the Euro, but a high proportion of the population say that they believe the UK will be in the Euro in the relatively near future, and I take that as a demonstration of that reasonable openness and flexibility among the electorate.
Terry, just before you leave that, can I just try and press you on that gentleman's question? I didn't entirely understand what the scheme was.
Yes.
But can I ask you this? What you're saying is that we shouldn't make a fetish about tax. We shouldn't tax for tax's sake. The tax take of the government should depend on the state of the economy, the buoyancy of tax revenues, and what the government needs to spend money on. Is there, though, an additional argument that in a society where there are vast accumulations of income and wealth held by the mega-rich in society, that there is a meritocratic reason or justification to stop that sort of wealth cascading through the generations, which in itself is an obstacle to mobility and a barrier to a genuinely meritocratic society being created?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this has a long history in political analysis, as I'm sure you're only too well aware. It goes back, for example, to Emil Durkheim, who I think Will has recently been reading. Emil Durkheim said that there should be no inheritance of wealth whatsoever because that's a means of creating a meritocratic society. I think in this country at the moment, we in a way get the worst of all worlds on the relationship between inherited wealth and inequality because there's not a big tax take there in terms of inheritance. Admittedly, it's not very popular among the electorate to raise it. But nor do we have what they have in the US, which is much more philanthropic culture. And in the US, really interesting studies of what the rich do in America, which shows that they actually give away more of their wealth than is taken in several European countries which have quite high rates of taxation on richer people. So, you can have a combination of those things, but at the moment I fear we're losing out on both of them. And certainly it's true that a meritocratic society, a more egalitarian society, is not compatible with direct transmission of wealth between the generations, and we do need to look at that as a very significant issue.
Dominic?
Well, two words. The first one on the last point, I agree totally. I think the main problem we have to face is not income tax or indirect taxes, but inheritance tax. And obviously, the way inequalities are reproduced generation after generation are linked not only with inheritance, because you also inherit all culture, education, and a lot of things like that, but at least if we could limit the fact that the financial and real estate assets and so on are transmitted from generation to generation in reproducing too easily the inequalities of the previous generation, I think we will do a good job. The situation is not only this one in the United States, where the rates are very high compared at least to the French one, but in Japan. In Japan, the inheritance taxes are that high that if you're not able to increase the wealth you receive in three generations, it just disappeared. So the question of meritocracy is directly linked. The other point I would like to make very rapidly is that obviously high taxes, income taxes, I mean, are disincentive. Would you say that?
Disincentive
to work. But if you're discussing of what kind of taxes you should have, you must think for a given amount of revenue, because if you need less taxes revenue, of course it's easy to diminish all the taxes. So given an amount of tax revenue you need, what kind of taxes should you implement, owing to the question of the incentive to work. And then the problem is that if you have lower taxes on high income, you must have higher taxes than before on low income to have the same revenue at the end, which means that the system will be less progressive than it was before. And then you come to the question that what are you expecting? Could you expect more productivity gains and efforts from the high level of income or for the low level of incomes? And so incentive process can act at one end of the income distribution, but also at the other end of the income distribution. And then you come to a very important question, at least in my country, which is that the main unemployment question is linked with an unqualified or less qualified people. So if you're interested in those people, if you think the main thing you have to do is to have those people to make an effort to be more qualified, then you have to put all the incentive you may have on those people. Just because if not, the incentive for them to learn more, to train, be more trained, and to earn more will be there. So it's a question of balance on which part of the society you want to influence most.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take.
Could I just say one thing more? I forgot to say this. I think there's another form of inheritance we should be against, and that's an inheritance of poverty and deprivation. And partly through the sorts of studies that Anne and others have done at the LSE, we know that there is a cycle of reproduction of deprivation and poverty, which does not just depend upon having a low income, but depends upon a range of factors which simply reproduce these things across the generations, and those things we need very strong policies to try to counter.
Now, one question we didn't address is this issue of public participation in decision making, which, I mean, I don't know whether that's a question about internet or direct forms of public participation in politics, or what you were getting at. Yeah, Reinhardt.
If you allow me just 30 seconds to give my comment on the taxation issue.
Yeah.
I don't think...
Oh, sorry, I thought you were coming in on...
Doesn't matter. I firmly believe that it is not a very charming point on the agenda of the left or the center left or the modernizing parties if we are tax raisers. I firmly believe that we should be the ones who give incentives to society to make, and this is where I want to make the point and try to build a bridge towards the problem of participation, to enhance people, to encourage them, if they have money, if they inherit amounts of money, if they make a lot of money from on the stock market, so wherever, to contribute and to do this and to give it into the society through foundations, through participation, through organizations of civil society. I think until we can ask our peoples to pay more taxes, we should do a hell of a lot of things and offer them a hell of a lot of opportunities to do it otherwise on their voluntary needs before we oblige them to pay more taxes. This given the fact that they are paying a lot of taxes already. Now, the point of participation is touched by this. I think I firmly believe that there is a logical connection between voter participation and active participation in social and economic life. And I think I wouldn't address the participation issue on a solely political level, like how can we enhance voter participation, without addressing how can we enhance participation of the working people in the working process? How can we enhance participation of neighbors in their neighborhood? How can we enhance participation of the individual in its community, in its neighborhood, and in its social surroundings, in its networks? I think all the ideas of have more referendums, have less referendums, have more mobilizations, have less mobilizations, have more clear-cut programs, less clear-cut programs, don't actually touch the point. The point is the European, and especially the so-called leftist European heritage of ideas, is a set of ideas which is firmly based upon participation of the individual, not only in the product that he's creating, but also in the decision of what is being done with this product. And this starts in factory work, it starts in the kindergarten, and it starts in parent participation in education business, and it ends in voting. And I think this is the broader issue which we should have to address. And I think there is a there's a clear shortcut to taxes here.
Anne, do you want to come in very, very quickly on the public participation? Very quickly, then I'm just going to take a couple more questions and then we'll close.
Only to say that one of the projects we're doing is tracking 200 families in low-income neighbourhoods, and one of the things that those families care most about is what they call community relations, the need for it, the loss of it, the lack of it, and how they can be more connected into what goes on in their neighbourhood. The second thing that they say is that they feel they have very little or no influence on what happens. And the third thing that 3 out of 4 of these neighbourhoods are trying to deal with is a very rapid change in population composition, a large increase in migration, refugee dispersal, and all of the pressures that that implies. So you can link those three things together. People want more community. People want more influence over what happens. People are very, very tolerant when actually confronted with a hugely diverse and rapidly changing community, but they don't feel that they've got a way of actually influencing and shaping those neighbourhoods for the better. So disaggregating many more of our decisions down to neighbourhood level, as I think our German colleague was suggesting, is absolutely key to actually capitalising on the social networks that people care about and feel are important.
Okay, thanks, Anne. Right. Another question there.
Yeah, it was a question to the same to the same member of the panel. It's on immigration. Immigration seems to be a very big problem for the social democratic parties of Europe, like Austria and Denmark. Two questions: can that also end up being one of the biggest problems of New Labour, and how does New Labour avoid that?
In immigration. Gentleman over there.
Thank you very much. Very straightforwardly, we're now for constitutional change. There's been a lot of progress on proportional representation, and I'm thinking particularly of the electoral system at Westminster and also the proposals for reforming the Constitution for Europe, the IGC, in, I think it's 2004. Thanks very much.
Right. Lady just there.
Thank you. Just thinking about, there seem to be questions about where to next for Labour. One thing that hasn't come up is housing and the lack of affordable housing for many people in this country. If we look at the minimum wage that they've managed to sort out, a lot of people on that wage still actually owning their own home or having somewhere decent to live is still very, very far away, and that's quite a necessity. Just want to see what the panel think about that.
Okay, thank you very much. A couple more. Gentlemen over here.
Can I just go back to the question of the marching tune? Essentially, with Tony Giddens' idea, seems always to be that the rich, in some senses, should be implored to do a little bit more, as it were, and that the poor, in some senses, should take advantage of their opportunities. And I just wonder whether this is enough compared to the sort of old Labour idea of equality. And is the marching tune only going to be always look on the bright side of life, in the sense of it can't be too bad, or is there going to be something more with New Labour?
Well, it was actually the guy beside you, but if you want to...
Sorry. I'd like to go to the question, specifically look at the prison service and how it's run, and whether New Labour are thinking ahead of taking steps to incorporate rehabilitation into the prison service, as opposed to the idea of simply just locking people up for a lengthy period of time. That's what I'd say.
Virginia Bottomley. Just here. Don't be shy.
Well, I bring a clear mind to it because I haven't read The Independent, and I have been enjoying reading the Fabian pamphlet very greatly. But what distresses me a lot about New Labour and the future is why they're so mean-spirited towards the leadership and management of the public services. Why there's such an aggressive blame culture, why there's such a political agenda. Because I have long thought that people work in the public services, whether health or the prison service, police, all the rest of it, are basically committed to a general good. And the alienation of people in the public services is very serious indeed, and I fail to understand it. I'm sure more money is needed, and whether that is raised through taxation or through co-payment is a matter that can be debated endlessly between the parties. But I fail to understand their lack of generous and decent leadership of the public services and management.
Virginia, can I just put that back to you? And I don't mean to do this in a sort of cheap and nasty partisan way. I mean, sort of like, genuinely I don't. But when your party was in power, there was a great deal of emphasis on reform of public services, National Health Service in particular, you, Ken Clark, whatever. How did you deal with this issue? How did you, at the same time, applaud the public spiritedness and commitment of people who work in the public sector, and at the same time challenge them in the way that you did to change as radically as you wanted, carrying the implication that what they were doing, or the framework or system or structure within which they were working, was imperfect and needed to be sorted out? How did you manage this in your case?
If Tony wants to organise a further event, I'm very happy to speak at it.
Yeah. But it is a very important question, though, because I have it all the time in my constituency.
Well, I'll give you a very small and specific example. There was a chief executive of the NHS who had an arm's-length relationship with ministers, and the idea was that the NHS would become more and more like the BBC and more distanced. What happened was that distinction was eroded. They got rid of the independent chief executive and made the person a permanent secretary, i.e. brought them right in under ministerial diktat. It's just one small example. The trust chief executives were answerable to their boards, and the idea was trust would become more and more like universities and really semi-independent from government. The accountability was completely closed down into a kind of Soviet-style accountability to the centre. Mm. And it's a huge sadness, because NHS managers are really good and decent people. And a lot of them are deeply disillusioned. And I, as my school Labour candidate, disciple of Brian Abel Smith here, great-granddaughter of one of the original signatories of LSE when it was founded, even I thought that when New Labour got in, there would be areas where there would be a greater generosity of spirit. To my horror and amazement, in all those areas, there has been a sort of vilification of people in the public sector and their commitment and their ethos, and a reluctance to let them speak independently or freely, which I find extraordinary.
Mm. I mean,
said too
I,
much.
No. I think it's a really important point. Really, really important point. Because anyone who, you know, as we do, represent people in our constituencies and deal with people in the public sector all the time, have a real challenge on our hands in both applauding, encouraging, nurturing that commitment to the public sector, and at the same time act as sort of carriers of the government's message, which is that, you know, with money must come modernisation and change and reform. Now, I think it is possible to do that. I think it is possible to demonstrate a commitment to the public sector, as I believe this government is doing, both with money and a message of change and reform without making the mistake which I think you correctly identify of the first term of the government, which was a sort of command and control, sort of centralising tendency. I think almost the government's and ministers' sort of ambition and combined with their haste, combined with their desire not to sort of come under the sort of lash of the media for sort of going too slow or not sorting things out quickly enough or whatever, led to a tendency by ministers, to draw the reins into themselves, to accumulate power to the centre, in order to, take on those who perhaps they imagined or perhaps in reality might defy that change. It was a sort of sense of, look, we're an engine going at, full pelt here. And we don't want to be derailed, we don't want to be held up, we don't want to be sidetracked. You must let us through, and we're going to put all the power of central government behind it. And I think that's changed. I think it's changed. I think it is. This is sparking a very good debate. The reason I think it's changed is because I think that with the sort of Milburn tendency in the National Health Service and what the implications are of primary care trusts and GP-driven local health service management and control over spending means is that you have a sort of redirection of that tendency from the centre away to the grassroots, and I, for one, welcome that very strongly. But would you like to disagree with that? Without making this too parochial.
I would say that there is a serious problem. If you sit in a health trust, even now, the amount of paper, circulars, advice, guidance, you think of another synonym, it's another bit of coloured paper, coming in all the time, absolutely hasn't changed the rate. And one of the things that I think is really worrying, in addition to what Virginia says about undermining morale and making people feel that they're not valued, is also that the amount of direction from the top means that there is very little room for people to think about the priorities for the organisation that they are running, so that they have a tiny little business plan which incorporates all these guidance memos and so on, and you say to a chief executive, okay, but what are the really important things for this trust to do this year? And they go, oh, it's a totally, they just do not have the room to take the time to think about that.
Yeah. Can I just say how much I agree with that? Because I actually work in the public sector. So in universities, we see all these things up front. There's a mountain of paperwork that universities are also being forced to engage with. And I think it's just misapplied audit culture. And I think you actually need more professional autonomy and devolution in most public services, and I think that's where the government should be moving. So,
German perspective on this?
Yes, without interfering in the British debate here on the NHS. we all know that the German health system, for instance, praised as it has been, is facing bankruptcy. And we all know that the solution...
Well, not everyone in this country does know that, actually.
Okay, well, I'm going on record with this here. The minister,
good for you to
our talk. Our minister has this morning, so I may. we're facing enormous problems. We're facing enormous difficulties. Although, by all OECD standards or whatever, the German health system will still fare pretty well in comparison to other European or different systems. The problem is that the system is no longer sustainable. It creates costs that are not payable anymore, and it is a disincentive for employment, because health insurance is becoming too expensive, and is part of the labor cost, and labor cost is soaring up too high, and disincenting employment. The trouble here is, and I think again, devolution on the side of the state is one of the musts, and the other must is a whole process of rethinking society. Because if you have a system like Germany has in healthcare, where everybody's entitled to go to a doctor, and if he doesn't go out of the doctor's clinic with a prescription for at least 60 marks or 30 euros at that, he will not feel treated, and he will become even more sick because the doctor didn't take him seriously. No, I'm not joking. We are really a very inefficient system, and probably this is very. There's a lot of reasons to it. I've talked to doctors. Doctors tell me, well, I understand this because going to the doctor in the morning for a lot of people is the only person they can go to talk to. Well, this tells us a lot about our society, but it's not the healthcare system which could make up for this. So again, devolution on the side of the bureaucracy and de-bureaucratize. Get closer to the needs of the people, but on the other hand, enhance a mentality change. How do we want to live and build our modern society? Now, let me just because I took some notes here. There were questions which might have needed some answers. Immigration was one question. I don't know if this was just for the British side. As far as the Germans are concerned, I can tell you something, and this brings me back to the modernization aspect. And I would be actually interested, maybe Tony, you can give me some update on that. In Germany, when the Social Democratic Green Coalition took over in 1998, on the whole field of what we call Gesellschaftspolitik, which is not social politics, but what is politics that's influenced the way how you conceive a society and how you see yourself as a society, was a very, very backward country. We were still sticking, for instance, to the nationality code, to the citizenship code of the Wilhelmian Reich, which was a blood code and not a ground code or jus. Well, at that point, it was jus sanguinis and not jus soli. We've changed that against a ferocious campaign. When the Red-Green Coalition took over, all the conservative parties and a large part of the majority of the population were agreeing we are not an immigration country. Now even the CSU, the most right-wing part of the conservative party, is negotiating with us on an immigration law. Well, they're still very restrictive on it, and they still want through the back door. They want their same policy. They call it immigration, and meaning we don't want immigrants. But at least they agree now to the idea that we are a country to which immigrants come and a society which is well served in absorbing and in inviting immigrants. So I think immigration indeed is a very, very interesting thing, because this is the test of inclusion. And this is a test for our politics. I mean, how much and how far are we able to include, and how far are we able to integrate? Or are we just propagating the wonderful idea of immigrants coming to our countries and that they should be there, and then we put them usually into those quarters where there's people who are already facing social exclusion as far as rents are concerned, as far as workforce is concerned, as far as education is concerned, and we just leave them alone, and then we find out eventually, okay, well, immigration doesn't work because there is no integration. Because we create ghettos, and we don't create social progress on that. So I think one point is immigration has to be rationally assessed, and I don't see any point in waving the flag and saying we are all open societies, and everybody from all parts of the world should come into our societies and live here, no matter where he comes from or how he comes from. We should have criteria. We should have criteria for sheltering those who are needy, or sheltering those who are, of course, who are political refugees, but also a certain portion of social refugees, and invite those who have certain qualifications. But we should not indulge into illusions that we can, just by proclaiming to be tolerant and multicultural people, that we can create multicultural societies, because this will draw back on those on the poorest in our societies, and they will create more disintegration than integration. Now, a little last remark, because the other question I was remembering was about the Constitution. I reckon that you address yourselves more to the British part of the panel. I just want to make the statement that you might have followed the discussion in Laeken. They were not only about Parma, and not only about who is making the best ham in Europe and who could control the best ham.
There was a thing which is very, very complicated called the convention, I think. In German we call it convent, which was institutionalized in Laeken and which will and shall and must, I think, and there we come back to the problem of participation, must see to it that we get a more transparent European process, that we get a more that we get a clearer approach to who is doing what in Europe, where is the national state responsible, where is the European authority responsible, where is, and if there is a authority in Parma authority for Ham responsible, what is it exactly responsible for, and how can people participate through their national states and through the European Parliament? Now, I agree with you that a convention is about as funny as a baby funeral. And you won't be able to mobilize a lot of people around it. But if we get this into our minds and into other people's minds, that this is the point, and let's go back to the idea how euphoric people are on the continent where they are paying in this funny money, which is called the euro. And people are really europhoric. So maybe this is the point where we should really collect them and get them to be engaged in these questions. Thank you.
Dominic, just take up the point about Europe. Very briefly, but then I'm going to go back, to housing and immigration with Anne.
The question of the Constitution is obviously a question of what has been said just before, mainly the question of subsidiarity and what should be done at a different level of the Union. And obviously, as there's no reason why we should accept for a longer time that question like fox hunting will be decided in Brussels and not in the country where you have really fox hunting. I can understand that. So we have a lot of things to do as far as the need, we need to redefine subsidiarity. But the Constitution is not, well, it's part of the problem. There's another part of the problem, which is what kind of a unity, of cultural unity, we're able to define in Europe, what Jürgen Habermas called constitutional patriotism. Are we able to have something which will be not the history of Germany, not the history of France, not the history of Italy or the British history, but something which make it possible for European citizens to feel European? And I'm not able, of course, to define it now, but obviously the question of the euro is part of it. And the currency, having the same currency, is not the same history, it's not the same culture, but it's the same something. So this part of constitutional patriotism, the fact that we're able to build a consciousness of being a European citizen, through which will be at the end of the day written in the Constitution or not, which finally it's not the question, this problem has to be solved, at least has to be discussed in the convention, and it will probably be the first time where we'll have this kind of discussion outside academic circle or things like this. So it's a very important period which is now open with this convention. And, the fact that it's going to be chaired by Valéry Giscard d'Estaing is not obviously a good news, but maybe it's not a bad news. We will see.
Well, at least he's a Frenchman. Now, Anne, will you respond to question on affordable housing, on which Will also wants to have 30 seconds, and then I'm going to go back to Michael Jacobs to have 30 seconds on decentralisation of public services, and then I think we draw it to an end.
Okay. Affordable housing is really, really problematic. If you ring up Manchester City Council, Newcastle City Council, Birmingham, Glasgow, Belfast, and most towns and cities north of Watford, you could walk into affordable housing. There is a surplus of affordable housing. We're also building faster than households are forming in most parts of the country. But in global cities like London, the very opposite is the case. And in all popular neighbourhoods and all popular places right across the country, no matter how far north, south, east or west you go, you'll have difficulty finding affordable housing. So there's a complete contradiction between a very large oversupply of what is our most affordable housing supply in most parts of the country, and some of it can't sell and a lot of it is being demolished, and what happens in big cities. There are some things that, so I'll just say a couple of words on what can be done in the real pressure areas. If you repair rather than demolish, it's a lot cheaper in almost all cases. if you create smaller housing units for the much smaller households than we mostly are now, then it is a lot cheaper. If you create more mixed communities, then places are more popular, so you have less empty property, you therefore have a higher supply. If you have more community-based solutions in poor neighbourhoods, you will actually generate much, much better use of scarce regeneration and repair resources than you will by marching in with very large schemes. So there's an awful lot that we could do to save and improve and reuse and bring back into use what is actually a very, very large stock of housing. We have a huge built environment. We are an old industrial urban country. And our big problem is that we don't manage it very well. We don't incentivise repairs. We charge VAT on repair but not on new build. It's a lot easier to build on a greenfield site than it is to grab a city site in the places where it's needed and so on. So we basically have to use our brains a bit more in order to make affordable housing work. At the end of the day, though, access for low-income people is always difficult. And unless there are structures for ensuring that that affordable supply is in place, then the lower-income households will always get squeezed out. And if you put in conflict with each other, new coming immigrants and traditional communities that have never been housed very well, then you're creating recipes for trouble. So that is another huge community brokering issue around housing that we've not done very well so far.
Will?
I really will do just 30 seconds. I think that housing that you spoke about is a direct reflection of phenomenal income inequality, and that what's happening is that the increasingly well-off are able to gear themselves up with astonishing mortgages. I think that the pattern of house prices in Britain is only partially reflecting the pattern of income inequality. I think we have further to go in the better parts, better houses and neighbourhoods being priced more highly. I think the chance of getting affordability within those areas, notwithstanding what Anne said, is close to nil, unless we attack the origin of it, which is income inequality. In particular, when you get joint incomes, mortgages of a quarter of a million in the better parts of London are commonplace now. You can drive from Muswell Hill to Richmond Park and never go down a road where there's not one house worth less than £1 million. That adjustment is to levels of income inequality, which I think that Tony was wrong to be so careless about. I think the story of the next 10 years is going to be the story of this housing question reflecting patterns of income inequality, becoming, like transport, one of the number one political issues in Britain.
Okay. Now, Michael, you want to say something about decentralisation of public services?
Again, very quickly. I'm delighted to say, probably for the first time in my life, that I agree with Virginia Bottomley, who I think has hit an important important point about valuing public sector work, not just public sector workers, but the idea of public sector organisations and the public realm. And I think this is a critical part of how New Labour needs to talk about public services, valuing what it is that is different about the values, the motivations, the ethos of public organisations. And I think that's very important. But I think we do have a major political problem, which is the one that the lady who talked about all the directives coming down from Whitehall, which is Labour is caught in a terrible, terrible bind. Which is, on the one hand, I do think it now recognises that the way you improve public services is by decentralising, by giving local authority and public sector managers more autonomy and so on. But it is caught by a political system which is demanding fantastic centralisation of accountability. In the end, this government, largely of its own making, not completely, but partly of its own making, has set itself the task of being re-elected on the improvement of public services. Now, these public services are actually delivered by thousands and thousands of different public sector managers and organisations, and yet the government is saying we are accountable for all of them. And so it's caught by this bind of, on the one hand, realising that you need to decentralise, and on the other hand, demanding all the central control because it is centrally accountable from the national centre. And this brings us back to Tony's book and also to the experience of other European countries. The decentralisation of political power and bureaucracy, for example, in Germany or Spain or wherever, seems to me to be a very, very important model that we have to get away from single national uniform public services. And secondly, as Tony argues, we need to accept diversity, pluralism, including regional pluralism, in the culture as well as the structure of government. And that's something which the UK has long, as a very unitary state, found very difficult. And I very much welcome that debate, which should arise, and I hope in the future will arise, from Tony's excellent book.
Okay, now I think that must bring us to a conclusion. I'm acutely aware that we haven't responded to all the questions that were put. Gentleman over there asked a question about the party's marching tune. And I think this is, when we talk about the future of New Labour and where does New Labour go from here, I think that's a very good question, because I think that many people who are supporters of the Labour Party, voted for the Labour Party, or are members of the Labour Party, like what the Labour government is doing. Anyone with any idea or half a memory of Labour history know that this government is succeeding in ways and in areas for longer with greater public support than we've ever achieved, really, in the history of the Labour Party. And that goes for the 1945 government as well. I say that. Government of which I was very proud to have a grandfather who was a member of, but it ran out of steam after, what, 4.5 years, crashed after 5, and was not seen again, the like of which was not seen again for 13 years until Macmillan failed. So we are already succeeding, I think, as a government in a way that previous Labour governments have, but there is a sort of malaise, sort of sourness, a desire to know what it's about and to be able to sum that up and to encapsulate it in the sort of marching tune you were talking about. For me, I have to say, representing a North East constituency as I do, you know, the marching tune is pretty clear. It's about mobility. It's about people making good. It's about people having opportunities to change their lives. And, you know, Will, when you talk about, you know, going on a journey from Muswell Hill to Richmond Park and experiencing the, you know, value of our houses, you know, this is worlds and worlds and worlds apart from how and where the bulk of the population of this country live, what they aspire to, and what they count as vaguely realistic in achieving in their lives. In the article I wrote in the Guardian today, I said that, you know, what I want to see and what I fight for and what I believe animates or should animate New Labour, you know, is social mobility, the ability of the daughter of a shop assistant in Hartlepool to have as good a chance of becoming a High Court judge as the daughter of a Harley Street doctor in London. That is absolutely unimaginable. And I'm afraid, you know, it's not just a question of income. The income discrepancy is huge. But there are, in so many other different respects, reasons why, for people who live in other regions and parts of the country and constituencies like my own, for them to have that sort of ambition and aspiration is completely unimaginable. It's not just a question of income. It's about educational opportunities. It's about the people you mix with, the people you meet, the sorts of jobs and occupations that you can do, you know, in your holiday time, where you can afford to travel. These are literally worlds apart that exist in our country. And the emergence of the creation of a knowledge-driven economy in the information age and the information divide that is emerging in the United Kingdom is going to exacerbate and deepen these divisions and not lessen them. And so, you know, for me, you know, creating a sort of a genuine sort of meritocratic society where people, whoever they are, whatever their backgrounds, whoever their families, wherever they're brought up, you know, can have the same, can share the same sort of ambition and aspiration and equipped with the same chances and ability to fulfill their potential is, in my view, what should animate New Labour and what, you know, we're all about as socialists in our, or social democrats, whatever you wish to call yourself, in our party. And I think if I sort of felt anything about, you know, this current phase of New Labour, I mean, we went through 1994 to 1997, you know, creating a sort of modern left-of-centre party. From 1997, after we were elected, we went to 2001 in a second phase of New Labour, you know, creating a sort of modern, competent party of government with huge economic credibility acquired in the process, as Tony was describing. I think we are now in a third and critical phase of New Labour, which requires deepening our project and deepening what we're about and creating ambitions and equipping ourselves with the policies and the redistribution of opportunities and life chances in our country, for which we have, I think, laid and created tremendous foundations, but we are really only at the beginning, you know, of climbing those heights which we want to do. But that I think is the challenge for what I call the sort of the third and critical phase of New Labour. Heaven knows how long it will carry on for, this third phase. Another election after, I don't know. It doesn't get easier in what we have to do, but certainly challenging ourselves and renewing that project and what we're about, I think, is absolutely essential, which is what I think Tony's book is all about, and why I think it has, you know, contributed a huge service to our party, to New Labour, and anyone with a, you know, decent sense of socialism in their in their bones and their guts. So, thank you very much indeed. And thank you very much, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, for coming from Paris. Thank you very much, Reinhard Hesse, for coming from Berlin. Thank you very much to Michael Jacobs for coming all the way from Dartmouth Street in central London. Will Hutton round the corner in Carlton House Terrace. And Anne Power, who's come all the way from, which floor do you work in here? The second floor of the London School of Economics.
Thanks to Peter Mandelson, who didn't come very far but did a wonderful job.
Thank you.